Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, director Denis Villeneuve on Blade Runner 2049, Dune, and a Star Wars movie? Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz.
You just cracked yourself up on that one, didn't you?
I love the ...
Yeah.
The ellipse.
A big ellipse guy.
I'm also just very excited about this guest, Sammy. Sue me, I'm excited.
Okay.
It's so rare for me.
Yeah, you're never excited about your guest.
This one in particular, all the rest can go to hell.
I'm telling Ben Mendelsohn that.
No. Denis Villeneuve is the major guest, the one and only guest on this week's podcast. He is, of course, the fantastic filmmaker behind Blade Runner 2049 and Sicario and Arrival and Prisoners and Encendies. And he's just...
Prisoners?
That's right.
Oh, he knows Hugh.
another one degree away from Hugh.
Oh, I love this guy.
Okay, we don't talk about Prisoners at all, just so you know.
Oh.
This is one of those episodes where it was a rare opportunity to dive deep into a particular film, because Blade Runner 2049 is a film that I greatly admired. I've seen it 3 times. I really just...
You've seen it 3 times?
Yeah. I really like
this
movie.
You're psycho.
Okay.
Yeah. It's been out for like 15 minutes.
Just calm down.
Okay.
This was a movie that was so eagerly anticipated, and for, you know, people that grew up kind of worshiping the original Blade Runner, we were also curious about how Denis could possibly follow it up. And somehow, I think most people agree, he achieved something very unique and special, and yet still honored the first Blade Runner. Sadly, the box office was not that great. I don't know what to tell you guys. He made a great movie for you. Where were you?
Because you probably saw it for free all 3 times. That's why.
That's not true, actually. At least twice. 2 of the 3 times I paid for it.
Well, that third time it would have nailed.
Yeah, sure. Those $15 would have put it over the top. So this is a rare opportunity to talk to a filmmaker in depth about a movie that's recently come out. And we got to get into spoilers. This is a spoiler kind of conversation.
Alert.
There you go. So if you have not watched Blade Runner 2049 yet, I would advise not listening yet. Come back to us when you have. And for those of you that have enjoyed that film, this is going to be a very rewarding conversation, I think, because Denis now has license to talk at length about the choices he made in the film, his approach, and just sort of I got an opportunity to ask like kind of plot questions that I was certainly curious about. Plus, we got a chance to talk about his future. He's currently working on Dune, the much beloved book series by Frank Herbert, of course, that he is going to he's co-scripting right now with an intention to direct. And he talks about why he fell in love with that book early on and his hopes for that movie. And yes, as I teased with my ellipses introduction, I even asked him about a Star Wars movie, and I was actually surprised that he would entertain such a thing with certain conditions. So stay tuned. Listen to that part
conditional
of the conversation.
Star Wars.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, this is a guy that has his pick of the litter right now. He's been offered a James Bond movie. He's when you're able to like direct something like a Blade Runner sequel and the critics fall in love with it and everyone acknowledges that he did a great job with it, I think every studio is now like, okay, Denis is at the top of their short list. So he's in a great position. So that's the conversation this week. What else to say? We have survived Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Oh, I am full.
Are you? Too much stuffing.
Okay, we're taping this before Thanksgiving.
Pre-tape. That's good acting, though.
What's Sammy's pick of the week, by the way? What's the thing that you've been enjoying?
POW?
Oh, yeah, exactly. I'm a little slow on the uptake. It's from all that turkey.
Yeah.
It goes to my head.
Yeah.
What have you been watching?
Like your turkey sandwich you had for lunch?
Exactly.
Mindhunter.
Oh, I'm jealous. You've seen all of Mindhunter.
Yes. You'll love it because you're the psychopath. So you're going to be like, I really relate to these guys.
Why are they bothering these poor serial killers?
It's Jonathan Groff. I'm a big Groff fan.
I know a lot of people are. I was at an event where he was the other day, and like people around me were very excited, and
yeah.
I haven't seen him in things. What would I have seen him in?
Okay, well, theater. It was Spring Awakening.
See, I never saw Spring Awakening.
Well, that's why you're a bad person. he was amazing in Spring Awakening.
Okay,
then he hopped over to Glee for a little, and then he was in Hamilton.
Right, and I missed him in Hamilton. The one I saw him, he was not in Hamilton.
And he's wonderful. And he's so good in this.
He's one of the leads, right?
He's the lead.
Okay, calm down.
And he was at four rows in front of me at M Butterfly a couple weeks ago. So
there's a link. There's a connection.
I started it that night. I literally did.
That's amazing.
I was like, oh, I just saw him.
How many episodes?
It's like
eight or ten kind of
Yeah.
Okay.
8 to 10. I don't remember exactly because on Netflix they just go into the next one.
Right. They're so sly that way.
Yeah.
Like if you're not quick enough on the remote, like, oh, I guess I'm in the next episode.
I guess it's 4 days later.
I'm very excited. That's next on
my
list.
You're going to really like it. You all are going to really like it. Except for my mom. My mom didn't like it.
Oh, really?
It's a little too dark for her.
It's probably not a mom show generally. Not
she was
stereotype.
Like, I don't like it. It's too real. And I'm like, well, they were literally real. So
that's next on my list. That and American Vandal. That's it.
You know, American Vandal's really good, too.
Not to ruin a potential upcoming guest, but I did the show I most recently binged, guys. Here's a hint of who's coming up.
Who?
I watched The Crown.
You didn't tell me you watched The Crown.
I watched all of The Crown.
I just went to London because of The Crown.
Do you know who's coming up from
No.
The Crown? I haven't told you?
No.
Okay, I'm going to ruin it just because it's too cruel. Claire Foy and Matt Smith are both coming
up. Both
on.
Of them?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, we're all so lucky. We're so lucky.
They are both going to be sitting right where you are. Hopefully not on the same seat.
Are they going to see it? Oh,
yeah, they only get one seat to share.
I might have to come.
Okay, so let's
this is going to be so good.
Let's let Sammy lie down, and she has to collect herself. That's coming up in a couple weeks, I think. But for now, Blade Runner 2049 enthusiasts, sit back and relax. Here's one of the great filmmakers working today. I'm such a fan of his. Enjoy this chat with Denis Villeneuve. It's a huge honor and a great pleasure to welcome Mr. Denis Villeneuve to my office, a filmmaker I greatly admire. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
I have to say, you know, this is an opportunity that I wasn't sure I was going to get because Blade Runner came out and you were doing the crazy publicity circuit and there was so much secrecy. It was shrouded in secrecy. And all I wanted to do was talk to you at length about this film. So I'm glad we're getting the opportunity a little bit after the fact to delve into it.
Yeah, and it's a better environment and a better timing because, as you rightly said, that as I was doing the press tour, it was just under an insane pressure of secrecy. So it's like we were not allowed to talk about nothing.
Yeah.
So now let's say that the people that don't want to get spoilers stop that podcast now because we'll talk about that. We can talk about everything now.
Yeah, and I'll just get the congratulations out of the way up front because, I mean, I've seen this film three times. I greatly admire what you've done with this film. And it was, as you well know, a kind of an impossible task in terms of you know, there are few films like the original Blade Runner that exist in our consciousness in such a way. And it was almost, for me as a film fan, impossible to dream of what even a sequel would be, how you can honor a sequel, honor the original, and yet make something all your own. And somehow you were able to achieve that. So congratulations.
Thank you. The thing is that it's true that the chances of success were very small, but the conditions were there. There was at the beginning a very strong ideas coming out of Hampton Fancher and Ridley Scott brains. You know, there was like a strong dream on the pages, and Michael Green had written a strong screenplay. So that's why I get on board. I got on board.
Can we first, before we get into Blade Runner, talk a little bit about your background in terms of the films that you grew up with, in particular films that relate to Blade Runner, perhaps? Were you steeped in science fiction growing up? Was science fiction a great love of yours?
Yeah, the thing is that I grew up in a small village in Canada where the most exciting thing were the nuclear power plant at three miles away and the snowstorms. So it's like I grew up reading tons of graphic novels, sci-fi graphic novels coming out from Europe, mm-hmm. Metal Hurlant, heavy metal in English, I think, and then watching sci-fi movies on TV. You know, it's like the birth of the desire of being a director was definitely linked with science fiction. And I spent my teenage years writing stories, doing storyboards with a close friend of mine, dreaming about doing science fiction. So it was something that I had put aside, yeah. A dream that I was hoping one day will be fulfilled. It was a long journey, but I'm finally back in my origins.
Do you remember the first, or it can be one or two different experiences, going to a movie theater in terms of films that changed the way you perceive cinema? I mean, you know.
Oof. It's not the one movie. It's a lot of movies. Yeah. The way one of the first movie I have seen that... I figure out what was the job of a director was. I remember watching Close Encounter of the Third Kind or movies from Spielberg and feeling that there was something different, yeah. In those movies, and that because there was a name attached to them, and that man was like had a strong vision, and I discovered that he was an author, you know, and Spielberg was one of my main first influence. Coming out from a small place in Canada, of course, the movies we were having, I was in contact with were mostly Americans, you know.
Right.
Then, and strangely, from Close Encounter, there was that French character that was so hypnotic, and that was
Lacombe.
François Lacombe, played by François Truffaut.
Yes.
The great. And then, so strangely, because of Spielberg, I discovered the French New Wave. I got interested in Truffaut, and then I discovered Godard, and Godard was a massive, Jean-Luc Godard was a massive shock for me.
Yeah.
To see how playful and challenging and experimental can be the cinema, could be the potential of cinema, I discovered with Godard. And then I discovered Antonioni was a strong shock too. And then later, one of the strongest aesthetic shock was Bergman, Ingmar Bergman. Mm. For me, still one of my favorites by far. And Kubrick too. Yeah,
it's a beautiful, the way you describe it is beautiful, because that is the way I've experienced it, and many, I think, film fans experience it, is they all connect, whether it's through an actor that appears in one thing or another, or a director. You know, if it's Brian De Palma that's influenced by Hitchcock, you go back to Hitchcock and it's just never ending loop that is endlessly rewarding. I still feel like I'm learning, there's no end to learning unless you're Martin Scorsese and have seen every film.
Yeah, twice. Yeah, exactly. And me, I have massive holes in my cinematic culture. You know, there's moments in the part of the history of cinema that I still need to explore. And there are so many films that are done today. I'm trying to catch up. And the more I'm making movies, the less I have time to watch movies.
Yeah.
And I think it's right now, I just feel a big need to start to go back to the cinephile part of my life, you right. know.
you've been making the movies yeah. for a while. Now you need to go back and enjoy them. Let's talk a little bit about the anticipation going into Blade Runner. I was talking to fellow film fans that were so curious about what you were doing with this and what the whole team was doing. I was also talking to filmmakers that were very curious. I mean, I had a chance to talk to Christopher Nolan here. He came in for Dunkirk, and he was endlessly curious too. I mean, mm-hmm. he's just an admirer of yours, an admirer of the original film. Did you feel that from fellow filmmakers? Did you talk to other filmmakers or even show the film to other filmmakers?
The thing is that I think that it's Blade Runner for most of the people is an artistic object that is revered. I mean, it's like massively respected.
Right.
As Christopher Nolan told me, you're walking into sacred territory here. Like, I think people were very worried and are sometimes upset, and I understand why. Because if you told me that one of my friends or someone, another filmmaker, will have done try to do a sequel to this, I will have the same suspicious thing. When the first time I heard that they were planning to, Ridley Scott was thinking, I thought it. I remember saying to myself, "That's a fantastic, exciting, bad idea." You know, it's like you don't do that. It's like, why? And I'm myself. I feel there's a lack of. It's not true. There's a lot of original content that is still being made today. It's just that we don't have access to it,
right?
Because, I feel that Hollywood is in danger of the recycling mode. At one point, it will explode. There will be an inner explosion.
Yeah, well, it is an interesting time, as you well know, as a film fan, and for myself, especially when you look at studio films and what they spend a lot of money on. There's that push and the pull of. I think studios tend to want to make the familiar because they want a safe product for the audience. They want to make the audience feel like they know what they're getting and they can cash in on that. But inevitably, for me, I think for people that appreciate great works of art in cinema, it's the ones that take risks. It's the ones that put themselves out there.
Yeah, it's a thing. Is that the audience today is very different from the audience that was going to film theaters very few decades ago. I feel it's like there's like a hunger for project that people will recognize. They feel safe.
Yeah.
They want to see things that they are less. They feel less. There's less a desire for the unknown, it feels, yeah.
Right. And that's everything that Blade Runner is. It's like it's couched in the unknown and questioning yourself and question. And it's a film. Both of these films are filled with questions that you can debate with your friends for hours, which is part of the beauty of it. Was there a period of time where you were wrestling with whether to do this or not, or was it an instinctual, once it was presented to you as an option, was it too great an opportunity to pass up?
There was two things. The first, a deep excitement and a massive curiosity when they put the screenplay in front of me. I was moved that the two producers behind the project, Andrew Kosov and Broderick Johnson, are which I had done Prisoners with, when they approached me, I was moved that they had enough trust in me to do that. That I was really. But then there was two things. I read the screenplay, and I felt it felt strangely familiar. And meaning not that some ideas that were very strong and fresh, but it felt like I felt home. Meaning that. There was a continuity with the work I have done before. Mm. So I understood why, because at the beginning I said, why me? It could have been in the hands of a lot of directors, why me? But when I read it, it's okay, I understand. It makes sense. It's linked with what I've, it's in a direct, that was a very strange feeling. In the same time, I felt also that technically I was ready to do such a movie.
Yeah.
Now I had to make the big thing was I had to make peace with the idea that, as I said previously, the chances of success were very small, sure, very narrow, and that I could be banned from the cinematic community for the rest of my life for doing such a blasphemy.
Failure, yes.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. But it's just that, you know what, you make a movie of that scale, it's always risky, and it was a dream of mine to try to do a big science fiction movie like that, and right. I felt that it worked when I read the script to say, okay, if I risk everything, it's my last movie, if it's like that is very meaningful. It's like, yeah, and I love the story, and the first movie is part of my I would say my cinematic DNA in some ways. Mm-hmm. It's a movie that I deeply loved for the decades. So I said, all right. Once I agreed and I made peace with that, once I made peace with the idea that it was like. Like Ryan Gosling was saying, trying to aim as a little aim in that far away to be able to. Then I become free again, and I decided to do it. Yeah.
We're going to get into some more overtly spoiler territory right now, so I just want to say that. If you haven't seen the movie by now, as I've seen it 3 times, and I'll see it many more, go and check it out. And now let's start to get into some plot stuff, if we could, if you'll indulge me. I mean, one of the interesting things for me is that Kay's journey in this, in some ways, mirrors not Deckard's from the first one, but almost Batty's journey, Roy Batty. Like he wants to be human. He wants to feel he is has human qualities, just as Batty wants life. Is that something that occurred to you and the writers in terms of the story process? In terms of, a lot of people I know have gone back and looked at the original Blade Runner and even see Batty as almost the hero of that.
Totally. No, no. It's like it's in the new Blade Runner, we are following Roy Batty, and he becomes the main character. You know, as the first one, it's Deckard looking for Batty, and now it's Batty looking for Deckard. You know, and there's no, I will say a thing about Michael Green's writing. There's no coincidences. I mean, he's a very intellectual, a strong writer that. Thinks a lot. There's no coincidences.
I also love. I mean, you kind of have two antagonists in this film, in Wallace and Love, arguably. And it's interesting that we never get necessarily, you know, in you would almost expect there's going to be the final showdown, not only with Love, but there's some resolution or something with Jared Leto's character. But we don't see that. He never even shares a scene with. Ryan Gosling's character, Kay. Was there ever a consideration of that? Did you feel like that character didn't demand that kind of...
That's the thing I loved about the screenplay, is that it was quite bold in some regard, in different aspect. First of all, the first part of the movie is intellectual investigation of the character. It's like a more... slow burner, and there's this idea that one of the main protagonists is the two main protagonists don't meet. There's like, yeah, and those were that we rose those questions as we were writing the project, and I just felt that again, it's nice to try new ways of approaching a story, you know, not trying to feel secure because you apply a recipe, you know. We right. try to approach it in a different way, and I'm grateful that the producer had the guts to go there, you know.
In terms of your visual approach to this, and you know, the DP has been you know, cited. This is a gorgeous film and is just remarkable in what you and he were able to achieve in this, in terms of atmosphere and lighting, etc. And again, like, the first moments of the film are so unlike anything we saw in the original Blade Runner. It's a totally different kind of environment where, you know, in that protein farm, kind of a barren landscape, as opposed to kind of the cityscape that we associate with Blade Runner. How, you know, is it a negotiation for you in terms of like how much to show that recalls the original Blade Runner, and then how much to go in a different direction to show different kinds of environments? Was that something that you were wrestling with, or did it feel like, again?
The thing is that it's in the screenplay I had, there was like every time I was in the Rick Deckard's neighborhood, I felt secure because an environment that we knew right. What were the rules, we knew what was the look. What the world will look like are outside the outskirts of Los Angeles, and once you will get out of Los Angeles, what it will look like. One of the key elements that was in the screenplay was the idea that California will be struggling with a new kind of climate. It will be colder. Right. There will be snow, and that for me was massive. Being from Canada, you know, I was born in the snow. It's something I have a very intimate relationship with. And it can sound trivial or banal. It's just very, very specific for me. It indicates to me how people think, walk, behave.
There's also water everywhere in the
yeah,
film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's
yeah,
a motif of water.
But like in the first movie, there's the pressure of water, the ocean rose, flooded. Countries, there's like part of Los Angeles, there's a massive seawall that protects the city now called the Sepulveda Seawall. So everything west of Sepulveda Boulevard is flooded, you know, it's like bye-bye Santa Monica. So where I'm going is that the idea of winter indicate to me the idea of the light. And it's one thing that I always, the birth of the dream for a movie is always linked with the nature of light to me. So the idea at the beginning when I had the idea to create a silver white Blade Runner instead of a black one, like the first movie is very dark. And then I felt I had a key to open this world and to bring Ridley Scott's universe close to me.
Yeah.
To invade it, to transform it according to my own sensibility through winter, and that was a big revelation for me.
Is there a scene?
I want to say the please. Opening of the movie is the opening of the original movie.
I had heard that.
That it was storyboard, it was planned, it was written, it was supposed to open with that Sapper Martin, and I thought it was brilliant that Hampton and Michael Green went back to that and bring it back to the screen.
Well, and I also have to say your casting of Bautista. Bautista just is so amazing in that scene. He conveys so much through very little dialogue, just his presence, a lived-in. He's not that old a guy. He's playing a bit of an older character. But also just the, and I know you've talked about how like one of the fun things or interesting things about this is like, you know, we today in 2017, we're living in such a digital world and you've gone to like an analog world in this futuristic film. You know, that opening scene's in a farm, it's in a shack. And it's just fascinating to me.
Dave Bautista, for me, I deeply love Dave. I hope I will have the chance to work with him again because he's really a natural born actor. Very with a lot of depth. It was like I remember Ryan Gosling and I don't like to put words in someone else's mouth, but I mean I will say we both were in awe working with him. He's like and such a nice human being too. Yeah.
Is there a scene that you wrestled with in terms of how to shoot, like that you kind of like tried, where you were unsure for a while in terms of like what is the way to depict this on screen? Is it one stand out to you?
The thing is that when you make a movie like that, it has to be everything has to be very meticulously planned.
Yeah, you can't improvise on set.
No, but we did sometime improvise with the actors, but because I wanted to have that freedom, but otherwise everything is like storyboarded. So because you need to create everything, you know, all the sets, all everything. So the people need to know where you're going, and then also to plan. I like to storyboard. The more I do, the more I love the power of storyboarding, because you make so many decisions about the style of the movie, and it's like it allows you, it gives you more freedom at the end of the day. It allows you to improvise because you're so well, you're ready to shoot. But no, I don't think that there was a scene, because again, we were so ready when we started the shoot, Roger and I.
All those debates had happened months
and Yeah, definitely.
Was there, on the eve of release, was there one aspect of the film, whether it was a story point or a stylistic approach, that you were losing sleep over in terms of how it would be interpreted or received by an audience? Was there an aspect of the film you were worried about?
Oh yeah, but the old film. but mostly there's some scenes, like there's like a scene that gave me a little bit of nightmares as I was doing it. It's the casino fight. I mean, when the there's a sequence where Ryan Gosling and Harrison Ford are fist fighting, you know, right, in a very cowboy way, in the orgy of a holographic orgy, you know, like a visual, and that I was worried that I was really we work very hard to make sure that we were still in the Blade Runner universe doing this. It sounds strange, but it's a very fine line, because we were suddenly in contact with element of culture that people will recognize from the past.
Right.
And a technology that needed to be, like, you had to feel that those holograms were part of an older technology, that they were like filled with glitches, and the system were corrupted, and those holograms will create a kind of like digital painting where the characters are fighting through, and it's like I just wanted to make sure that, and there was several things that needed to happen in this scene at the same time for the characters. That scene gave me a lot of nightmares, I would say. Yeah,
a couple plot things that I'm curious about. Was there ever a mention of Roy Batty's character at any point considered?
No, but I will say that for me, I thought about Roy Batty a lot as I was shooting the movie. It's like it's such a strong, charismatic character. I felt that he was just beside me, telling me what to do. Because
in some ways, he's the most influential character on this film.
I'm so different. I have a very different sensibility than Ridley Scott, so my big challenge was not to go too far away from the original one. Yeah.
Was Kay ever in any incarnation considered to be their child? Was that always? That was never.
No. It was the original plot didn't change. Yeah.
Why does Love cry when she kills Robin?
I deeply love the fact that, you know, the replicants, they are beings that are very, of course, stronger than real humans. They are like more intelligent, but emotionally they are like very vulnerable, because they don't have the proper pillow of experience to digest emotions or to know how to react.
Exactly.
And I like the fact that Love is a bit psychopath. You know, she her emotional reactions are not. She's like very always on the edge, and she reacts. It's like the dots are not connected at the right moment. She cries at the wrong moment. The way Sylvia Oakes portrayed that character, I think, is very powerful. She brought a lot to the character.
Sylvia, who I've never frankly seen before in film, is amazing in the film. It's a revelation.
It was a revelation to me too. Yeah. Sylvia Oakes is an incredible actress. Yeah. Honestly, very strong artist.
Is it true that you were considering reteaming with Emily Blunt for that particular character, or?
Silence. Okay. The thing is, Emily is someone I would love to work with again, definitely. Emily, I had such a great time on Sicario with her. But if memory is good, Emily was pregnant at the time.
Excuse. Was the musical cue at the end always there, Tears and Rain? Was that planned in the script stage or the pre-production
stage?
No,
it's me who brought that that idea there. It's like it's a thing that happened. A movie is a living organism. At one point, it's like a Frankenstein. You put the pieces together and it start to breathe. It start to, the heart start to pump. You know, it's like really strange. And at one point, I feel that I have to listen and follow the movie. It has its own. And as I was editing, I was feeling more and more and more that it needed Vangelis.
Yeah.
It needed the sound of the atmosphere, the spirit of the. It was very impressive when you were putting the Vangelis synthesizers on the images. Then it was it was like closer to the what I wanted.
For me, it felt, having seen it a few times, the moments that really kicked in and felt like I was connected to the first film were like not necessarily in scenes where action was happening. It was when he's in the car, when he's traveling from one place to another. It gives you a moment to settle into the atmosphere and feel something.
Yeah. And honestly, I was a bit nervous when I brought this idea to put the score of the original tune on this moment, but it felt pure and perfect idea for the moment. Yeah. and to reconnect with the first movie at that precise moment, and everybody respond very strongly to this idea, so I decided to go on with it, even if it was a bit bold, I think, in a way.
I know the box office side, which we're not going to like dwell on, wasn't what everybody was hoping. I mean, you know, this is a film that, like the original, I think will live on for many years to come, just by the sheer audacity and quality of it. That being said, I'm curious, like, did you and the writers even sketch out a potential other story?
Listen, I just finished the movie a few weeks ago. We finished the movie and it was released the next day. You know, I don't have any distance. And me, I agreed to do one movie. We did that movie, and it was meant to be like a standalone. We gave everything. I know that the idea is not dead. I mean, it's like it could be possible that there would be another one, because from an artistic point of view, the producers and the studio are very proud of the film. Yeah. You know, very proud, and it could happen again. Yeah.
Do you have like the seed of the idea in the back of your brain of what it would be?
Some ideas, let's say that I need to the dust needs to settle down.
Need a second.
I'm really focusing on something else right now.
Right, and we'll get to that. I'm curious about your. I know that it's early days of Dune, but I definitely want to pick your brain a little bit about that. But before I get to that, I rewatched Arrival again, which I just adore as well. Do you see? I mean, Arrival was kind of your first, full-on foray into science fiction. Do you see a connective tissue between Arrival and Blade Runner? Did one?
The thing is that when you make movies back-to-back like that, one thing that is possible to make such a thing possible is when they are very different. There's a lot of connective tissue about the power of memories,
yes.
You know? And both movies are linked by this thematic, deeply.
And my question that puts you on the psychiatric couch for a second that I noticed in looking at particularly your recent work, I think all four of your most recent films are all in some way about a parent losing a child, it could be said.
There's something about the death of childhood that is. Which is a terrifying thing, you know. But it's not about. It's the metaphor, you know, of maybe how, as I grow up, I feel about society today. You know, there's something about innocence that is crushed right now. There was innocence when I was young. It was possible to be innocent. There was the presence of innocence. in societies, even if the world was still a violent world. Today, there's something like, maybe because of the means of communications, or I don't know, something is crushed. Yeah. And it's present in a lot of my work. Yeah, it's true.
One kind of filmmaking question that struck me when I was rewatching Arrival. I mean, I guess this is a question that's really, it's what a director does. The question is kind of generally, how do you know where to put a camera? Specifically, I was watching like the end of Arrival, where arguably the pivotal conversation between Amy and Jeremy's character, where they're kind of connecting, kind of for the first time, the romance is really beginning at the end. You shoot almost entirely from behind. You barely see their faces in that scene as you start to go into the flash forwards. What do you remember about
The thing is with Bradford Young, I did this movie with Bradford, the cinematographer, Arrival. The idea, the whole movie was shot in a very dreamlike quality. And there's something about the, it's very intimate to be just behind the neck of someone, a character. There's something, the power of evocation and the feeling of immersion is very strong when you're just there, just above the shoulder. And it's also like a dream when you, there's something that you cannot catch in the same time. There's a wish to see more, and in the same time a very strong intimate feeling.
Yeah.
That tension really appeals me, and it's always about finding the perfect spot where you want to put your camera, and it comes from preparations from an intellectual process on the dates, and very intuitive, and it's like an equilibrium between both, and I feel that it was a strong place to be. It was by far the most romantic place to put our camera. It was just close behind them, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It works. So your head is mostly in Dune right now, I would imagine. You and Eric Roth are working on the screenplay.
Yes, yes.
This was an important book for you growing up. Can you tell me sort of why you felt, or what you remember about falling in love with that book and what the connection was?
The thing is that I will give myself the permission not to talk about it too much, because it's always the same. Is that when you are in gestation, is it a word in English?
Yep, sure.
It's like kids, you're designing something. So the ideas are so fragile right now when you start to write something that... But let's say it's at the time, I just felt in love with the culture that was created by Frank Herbert, and what it was saying about religion, and the link between religion and politics, and the fact that it's a project that you can explore those themes very freely, with a lot of freedom, I will say,
Was there a childhood image or two that sticks with you to this day, that you, when you think back to first reading it? I remember seeing the cover of that book.
Me too. I remember walking in a bookstore, and the thing I never heard of. When you're that beauty of being born in nowhere is that everything is new.
Yes.
And nobody never talked to me about Dune. I discovered the book because I was attracted to the cover and it was the cover, the French cover was fantastic of the first edition. It was like, and
what was it? Do you remember?
Yeah, it's the close up of a black man with blue eyes above a desert, and it's a very strong image.
Yeah.
And very hypnotic. And my work right now is to reconnect with my first impressions and my first in the my memories of how I felt and the images that came out when I read the book the first time, the first original images, and to connect with that. And that's a very strong process. very exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I won't tell. I know you. It's so early. It's cruel to talk about too much. But I'm curious. Like, as you're writing this with Eric, do you think about from a filmmaking standpoint? I mean, like the epic nature of the story, the sandworms, etc. Like literally, like, do you think about like how I'm going to achieve that? If that's going to be CGI?
No. The beginning is like you. It's all about the dream. I must never think about how I will do things at the beginning.
I remember
first AD told me she was trying to write a screenplay, and she said, okay, well, I'm going to write this. No rain. Rain is too tough. And no dog. And don't put kids in the scene. And you know, you cannot start to write thinking about that. You have to go all the way, and then you deal with the problems.
Then the studio can say, that's not going to work. I mean, you're in such an exciting... This must be an exciting time for you as a filmmaker, that you're getting to realize kind of those dreams you had as a child. And, you know, you've been making great films for a while, but I'm just giving me a sense of sort of like where your head's at in terms of the opportunities that are coming to you. You have, you know, Bond came your way, I know, and I'm sure there are other franchises we don't know that have been offered to you, and those are probably very tantalizing, exciting opportunities. What are you going with your gut at this point in terms of like how you're choosing how to steer your career? I mean, what's your...
I always work the same way since the beginning. Is like I go, it's a call. A project needs to appeal to you. Sometimes I've been offered very, very nice project that I decline. Not because the project sometimes is very strong. It's just that I feel I'm not the right filmmaker to do it. Yeah. And it doesn't inspire me. The images are not coming out.
Yeah.
It needs to and why, if you ask me today, if I had nothing on my table, what I would love to do, I would say Doom. It's something that I said because I know that the images, I'm inspired by it. And if Doom collapse, I have no idea what I'm going to do. You know, it's like I put all my eggs in the same basket all the time.
Yeah.
It's not a choice. It's a call.
Did you, there's so much talk of the superhero franchises nowadays, so I can't imagine it hasn't crossed your radar. I'm sure maybe you've had a meeting or not with these companies. Have you ever connected with like a superhero? Have you ever felt connection?
No, because I'm not from that culture. I'm French Canadian, which means that my culture is European. I mean, I was influenced by authors from France and Belgium,
right.
and Belgium, sorry, and Europeans, a graphic novelist. So honestly, I knew very little about the most of them. I don't know them. I know sometimes I don't know. So it means I'm not the right person to do them. You know, if to do those movies, you need to love those characters. Me, I'm a stranger. You know, anyway.
what's your relation to the Star Wars franchise? Do you have a love?
That's different. I was like in 1977.
Like
I was 10 years old.
Okay. Yeah.
So I was the target audience. I'm a victim of that.
It infects your system. You can't
The two first Star Wars, A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, were like, I think Empire Strikes Back is the movie that I had the most. How can I say that in English? I was waiting the most. I'm really apprehension, you know.
Yeah.
2 years of like it. It was like. But it died with Return of the Jedi.
Not an Ewok guy.
I'm not that. No, I was like a pure believer, you know. I ate the third one so much that was the end for me.
Have you? Would you entertain delving into that universe if they came calling? Is that something that's intriguing?
It's something that, again, it's like... I will be intrigued. I don't know. It's a very difficult. What is dangerous with Star Wars right now is that becomes its own vocabulary. You know, I would love to see them. I think Rogue One was a very interesting attempt to very 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 interesting way to get out of the mold.
Yeah. It's interesting because, like, I don't know if you've heard, like, Rian Johnson, they've now kind of let him chart out another trilogy that apparently is unrelated to the Skywalker saga, as it were, which is intriguing because I think it's what you're talking about.
I think it will be time to do that because there's a limit to have daughters, neighbors, cousins, uncles.
How can everybody know a Skywalker?
I think it would be a great idea to get out of there. And to do something. Yeah, to go on a new part of the galaxy that I will be open to.
Okay, so they need another trilogy in an unrelated part, then called Denis. I was talking to Nolan. I know reveres Bond. He grew up I think he's. I have a feeling he's going to make a Bond film.
Me too. I think. I never talked about it with him, but I have that feeling too.
It'd be fascinating. Do you he said he has a take on it. He's obviously not saying what his take would be eventually. Did you ever get to that point of thinking of what you would do with a James Bond film?
I grew up with it too, and I deeply love James Bond. I will love to direct a James Bond. For me, it will be pure, massive pleasure, and
it's a long career.
It's a thing that I don't know. One day, maybe I hope.
Yeah. What have filmed?
But I have no. The truth is, it's a thing. It's that James Bond is again. It's another one that it's very. It's dangerous. It's sometimes crystallized a bit. I think that what Daniel Craig was able to do is fantastic.
Yeah,
fantastic. To reinvent again or reboot that character, it's a big challenge. Yeah.
Do you find yourself still inspired by other films and filmmakers? Can you recall recent films? I mean, you've been in kind of the box. You've been in the Blade Runner hole for a while.
Honestly, I haven't seen a lot of movies in the past years. Yeah. Okay, that's sadly the truth. But I will say that spontaneously, the two movies that I will say to you that deeply inspired me in the past, the first one is Under the Skin from Jonathan Glazer.
Yeah.
I deeply love that film. I mean, that it's like still up one of my favorites in the recent memories. And this summer, I must say, a movie like Dunkirk for me is why I love cinema.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like that for me. It's I think really a masterpiece. It's the best Christopher Nolan movie, and it's like. What cinema should be, you know, it's like it's all about exploration of movement and
tension. Cinema.
Pure cinema. Right? So yes, yeah. Sorry, I was lost in my.
No, I understand. Are you a George Miller fan? Are you?
I thought that when I saw. Mad Max, I was applauding at the end. For me, it was like an ultimate Roadrunner show. Exactly.
That's a good way to put it.
I thought that the level of pleasure in that movie was very contagious. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because ending on this note, it's I put you in the company of people like Christopher Nolan and George Miller, and that, and I think this is what you were getting at.
You are very generous.
Well, no, but what I mean by that is, you know, there's a lot of conversation I have on this podcast with people. As you can tell, I'm a big film fan, and I like many worry about cinema and worry about what's landing in the multiplex and what people are making, and all of these filmmakers that we've just mentioned, you all are creating films that need that demand to be seen on the big screen with an audience.
In a way, I feel myself. I'm happy you're saying so because it's really the way I dream about movies is to be seen on a wide screen, and I had just the privilege to do that when Blade Runner was released in several versions. One of them is IMAX, and it was the first time that I was doing a conversion of IMAX, and it was planned at the beginning. Roger and I shot the movie so it could be transferred into IMAX format.
Yeah.
I deeply love the IMAX version, the frame, the what it creates, and I think I'm going to shoot my next project for IMAX, definitely. Again, I deeply love that. I try to. I'm a dinosaur. I go the opposite direction. I go away from the iPhone screening experience.
No, it's funny how it's gone circular. Where I feel we're getting more 70 millimeter films. We're getting more films shot. The film seems to be coming back in a way, but thanks to people that are kind of guarding it, like Tarantino and Nolan. And I feel like, you know, there are certain unnamed blockbusters that I feel like the audience is getting it, that you can't just make it in a factory and just turn it out. It has to feel soulful from a unique point of view. So that's what I get out of your films. And I'm so appreciative of your time today. And
it was a pleasure to talk to you. I hope it made sense.
It absolutely did. You're welcome anytime. And looking forward to the next one. Congratulations again.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.
3 to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first 3 audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.